This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The program Abbott Elementary on ABC is giving audiences a lot to be thankful for. It takes the form of a mockumentary, but it's really a warm-hearted ode to beleaguered public school teachers in Philadelphia. The character's earnest determination under difficult circumstances is very much the point. Abbott finds its comedy in the everyday.
Teachers at a school like Abbott, we have to be able to do it all. We are admin, we are social workers, we are therapists, we are second parents. Hell, sometimes we're even first.
Mm-hmm.
Why? It sure ain't the money.
Mm-hmm. I can make more work in the street. Easy.
Now in its second season, Abbott Elementary is already being pegged as a modern classic. The show stars Quinta Brunson, who writes and produces the show as well, and Brunson has emerged as one of the sharpest and most sought-after voices in television. At 32 years of age, she recently signed a multi-year development deal with Warner Brothers. And she joined us at the New Yorker Festival last month.
I'm Doreen Saint-Felix, and I am a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm joined on stage by the inimitable Emmy Award-winning writer, actor, the writer, actor, and producer, Quinta Brunson. Thank you so much for being here with me.
I'm so happy to be here. Good morning, everybody. Morning.
We were backstage just a few minutes ago, and we were talking about the notion of crossover, which is to say, I think of Quinta as the comedy mocker that I saw on the internet, the videos that you made for BuzzFeed in particular and other skits. Whereas when the Emmys aired last month, my mother was like, that's the Abbott girl. And so I was wondering if you could talk about the culture of comedy on the internet versus comedy in network television, and what are the things that you have to do when you're thinking about the audience that's younger, the millennial generation Z audience online, and the more like intergenerational audience that you feed on a network television show?
Yeah, so I do consider myself a child of the internet. I was born in that special period where during my adolescence and my puberty, the internet was being born. Like Facebook was a part of my social reckoning. You know, when I was turning 15, MySpace was the biggest thing. And then once I got to college, that was the birth of Facebook. And memes and meme culture was a big part of my communication as a teenager. And so my sense of humor was right in that midpoint as well. I have so many older siblings and older parents, so the shows I watch with them ranged from The Jeffersons to Living Color to Living Single, from The Andy Griffith Show, because they would show me shows that they watched when they were kids, my parents, to Even Stevens, which I talk about a lot. I really felt like that was the Seinfeld of my time. And then also when I was a kid, you know, all that was really important to me, this sketch show that it was just as important to me as SNL. I was like, these two are on the same level. So here I have all this comedy inspiration. The internet comes into play, and then, you know, things like Funny or Die happen, and sketches like Pearl the Landlord were very, anyone know that? The Little Baby and Will Ferrell? Very defining for me. I think being able to put all those things together, the internet's like niche humor, and then, as you know, Twitter, which is a bunch of crackheads coming together. No sense whatsoever. So going to the network space with Abbott to me was a culmination of all that I had been built by. And I got to put everything I love about comedy, from the Andy Griffith Show to Tim and Eric to Martin, back into the network space. And that was super exciting to me. I do think technology widened the gap between like boomers and millennials and Gen Z, because we just were accelerating at a rapid pace because of the internet, and I wanted to bring everyone together, and I felt like Abbott was my opportunity to do that, and I think I pulled it off, and everyone's watching together as a family.
I think Abbott Elementary premiered at this really interesting time in the culture of television, which is to say Modern Family has its series finale, and Modern Family, in my eyes, as a television critic, was probably one of the last network television shows that people, the critical space, the kind of snobs, were like, okay, this is like a show that we need to pay attention to. And then in the 2010s, you have this notion that good television is not on network anymore. It's on streaming. Network is like 10 years behind the culture. And when Abbott premiered, I think there was a shock amongst viewers and amongst people who pay attention and care about this stuff, which is to say, this feels nearly avant-garde, you know? It's not only competing with the comedies on streaming, it's kind of outstripping them. And so I was wondering if you could sort of maybe take us into your process of how you take form, which in the sitcom space is so strict, and use that as an opportunity to make something that feels free and new and fresh.
Yeah. So when Abbott first premiered, it was kind of shocking for me to hear that people felt that way about network. I have never stopped watching network TV. I know people in this room probably don't like it, but I was like tuning in to Young Sheldon every week.
Which is the most watched television show in America.
The most watched television. And it's funny
because
I'll see people be like, who is watching this? Girl, everybody. Everybody is tuning in to Young Sheldon. One day I will pitch my spinoff, Baby Sheldon. The youngest Sheldon. It'll never end. I really appreciate the 22-minute format because I think it forces me to be more creative and make distinct decisions. I love the idea of an act break. You know, when you're breaking a show for 22 minutes, you don't have that much time for the characters to talky-talky-talk, you know? You don't have time for these long, drawn-out scenes where the characters talking about their feelings and nothing happens. With 22 minutes, you need a fun act break that's gonna make people come back after the commercial break. And I think that's so fun. I enjoy trying to make a comedy that adheres to that standard. I think about black and white movies a lot and how we still are trying to make something as good as the old black and white movies. And I don't think that network ever has to, you know, the 22-minute comedic format ever has to go away. I think it's etched in stone, and I think that we're always trying to be as good as it, even in the... It's why I think Netflix can't quite get it right. I'm like, because you don't have act breaks. You don't have any restrictions. And when it comes to comedy, timing is everything. And I don't really want to watch somebody be foolish for longer than... I don't. For 3 minutes is the maximum for somebody just being foolish. And if it's going longer than that, then it's a little exhausting for the audience with comedy. And that goes way back to the Three Stooges. You needed to get out of there and come back. But I'm not trying to see that for too long. Am I making sense?
You're making so much sense.
This is intimidating. I feel like I'm just... Yeah.
I'm curious to know how you do something that a lot of shows don't do, which is that you resist making television that feels like it was made, you know, with the internet in mind. There are very few jokes that feel like, oh, somebody in the writer's room was like scrolling Twitter and made something to like satisfy, you know, the loudest audience that we can think of.
So the internet is where people go to share their thoughts on media and on things, on like Twitter in particular. It's like, this event happened, now I will be tweeting about it. I don't look at Twitter at all as anywhere for inspiration. It's not inspiration, it's just people talking. And Abbott is really great because the stories of this school are unique to those walls. It doesn't concern itself with world events. You know, that was another cheat code of Abbott, is I don't have to bring in world events to the show. When we go into the Abbott writer's room, the news doesn't even matter. It just, we are talking about what is going on with these people in this school. It's really nice. And so I don't consider the internet at all. It's not a part of our process. And I think that it makes for better art.
Abbott Elementary is about a quote unquote serious issue, mm-hmm. which is that in America, the public school education system is shit.
Yeah.
And in many ways, that's the main antagonist of the show. And yet there's no strain of didactism in it.
Yep.
And so I'd love to hear how you sort of like do that balance, you know, like very serious subject, but have it be a comedy that goes down easily.
So Abbott is so much inspired by the people, everyday people. I find people who just wake up in the morning and go to their job. I find that to be the most triumphant, you know, and I watch my mom go to work every day. She never complained, which was so fascinating
and
to
me. And your mother is a teacher.
My mother's a teacher. She retired, but her, you know, her job is hard. I'm sure people in this room have hard jobs, way harder than mine. And you get up and you put your clothes on and you get out of bed and you go to fucking work. And people probably aren't that nice to you and you're not getting paid as much as you should. I don't care what you do. You're not getting paid as much as you should be paid. And that is the most triumphant act. There is nothing, you know, that I could do or the president could do or anyone can do that is more triumphant than someone going to their shitty job. It's not easy. And what was the second part of your question?
I'm just so enamored by you. I kind of forgot what I asked.
But, same
Doreen. Oh, no, I remember.
I feel the same about... Doreen is... we're not doing it?
This is about you. The second part of my question was how you avoid the show feeling didactic.
Oh, yeah. So going back to my mom and all the people I know who work hard jobs. There's this sense of joy that people maintain in the face of horrible situations. I was at the airport and just, I love TSA workers because they just joke amongst themselves while dealing with, you're literally, they're being asked to check for terrorism. That's crazy when you think about it, that, you know, just some girl from Brooklyn is just trying to get a job and they're like, hey, make sure it's no terrorists. What? And she doesn't want to do that. She doesn't want to, and then it's on her. If it's so crazy to me. I think about it a lot. It's wild, wild ass job. And still they find I love watching people just enjoy their lives regardless of what they've been asked to do. And that's what I always saw with my mom. She would still have a friend like Melissa. She would still find this peace and laugh, and the school district was getting on her nerves, but she loved the kids so much and she loved her coworkers so much that there was such joy in what she did. And that's what Abbott is based in. Janine should be sadder than she is. But she's not, because she gets up, puts her little outfits on, and comes into school, and in the face of so much disenchantment, still manages to be there, show up, and have a good time. And I think that's so special, and I think that deserves to be revered and reminded of it every day. I think it's crazy that we keep going. So much has happened to the human race. So much has happened to Black people. Like, why are we still here? But I don't know. Something keeps us going. Do you know what I mean? We really could have called it quits a long time ago. And somehow we just keep going. It's crazy to me. It's really wild. I don't get it. Slavery? I would have been...
I really don't know how to follow up. Literally the word slavery.
You're listening to The New Yorker's Doreen Sanfelix talking to Abbott Elementary creator and star Quinta Brunson. We'll continue in a moment with some profound thoughts on the politics of the Philly cheesesteak. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been listening to writer Doreen Sanfelix in conversation with Quinta Brunson, the creator and star of ABC's hit series Abbott Elementary. Doreen has written that with Abbott, Brunson has managed to find freedom in formula, making a mass appeal treat that feels fresher than a lot of buzzy streaming comedies. She's become the first Black woman to score 3 Emmy nominations for a comedy in a single year. They spoke in October at the New Yorker Festival.
You talking about race made me think about the more recent history of sitcom network television and some of the shows that came out that were created by people of color, by Black people, by Asian Americans. And the drama, the problem in a lot of these shows was race. So if that was Blackish, I mean, even Modern Family, it was about race, it was just about white people. Still counts. Fresh off the boat.
Yes.
And so this is maybe kind of like an inside baseball question, but were you at all, you know, cajoled or coaxed by network executives to make that more of the topic of the show? I think why so many of my friends love Abbott is we're like, this is amazing. This is a show in which, you know, most of the cast is Black people in Philadelphia, but it's not about race in the way that shows have been in the Obama era.
Honestly, I had such a good relationship with Warner Brothers, my studio, and by the time Abbott was made, I had already made two other projects with them. They knew that wasn't how I wanted to approach making something. Like, a show like Black-ish, I feel made Abbott possible because they did it so I don't have to do it. You know, everyone gets it that Black people exist. Great. Now I get to make a show about just things that aren't about being Black, but are about just stories. You know what I mean? I don't want to do a Black History Month episode. And there was a little bit of a push to do that, and I don't want to. I want to make whatever Abbott's version of that is, but our show is not a show that is like, here's the topic of the month, or here's what's going on in the world, like I said. So they have their own world, these characters in this show. Randall Einhorn, who is our director and an EP on the show, he also got me, whereas with other directors, I don't know. They were approaching it in a way that I didn't quite enjoy. But Randall saw the beauty in the school, and Randall was like, this needs to be lit a certain way. This needs to have a warmth. Randall did like a million episodes of The Office. He helped set the tone of what The Office looked like. And he knew that this show wasn't about paper. It was about children. So it had to be warmer. And it had to, he knew what lighting Black people looked like, which it's different. HBO and stuff, man, Issa gets to do stuff that is really hard to do in network TV still. It was hard for me to even have a conversation about a Black director. I kind of gave up. Thank God Randall came into play. Randall's not Black, but he...
He's an ally.
He's a creative ally. I just needed someone to... And my life is full of meetings, and to have a director who got it was really valuable to me, and he just understood. So I say all that to say I have a bunch of people who get it, let me work, and that's really important to me.
So I was watching the Emmys last month, and I felt such a surge of like the intergenerational power that I think Abbott Elementary operates on when you consider the space, distance and culture between your character and Cheryl Lee Ralph's character. Mm-hmm. And to see this actor who, I mean, has had a career for well over four decades, the original Dream Girl, finally get to have her moment through the vehicle of Abbott. I'm just curious, like, this is maybe kind of fangirly, but like, what is your relationship like with Cheryl? What does she smell like? You know, those kinds of things.
Cheryl is on set. She comes in humming a song, singing a song, saying hello to the whole crew. I'm very personable and I love my crew and stuff. So I say, hey, good morning, everybody. What's up? Good morning. Cheryl comes, good morning. Every morning. And sets this tone of reminding you that life is to be lived. And Cheryl is just constantly reminding me to live. Like, she is just, a life is for the living person. And I told her one time, I was like, well, my plan is you get to retire after this show. And she's like, honey, I'm never stopping living. I'm never going to stop working. I'm going to work until I can't work. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, that's what's up. It's nice to be reminded that life doesn't stop at 60. Cheryl is on a full track to live life as much as she can for as long as she can. And I kind of need that reminder sometimes because I'm so tired sometimes. I'm like, man, I'm retiring at 45. I am not doing anything anymore past 45. But she just reminds me that it's only over when you say it is. So she's wonderful. Did I say that part yet? I love her. Yeah, it's like having a second mom. Sometimes she texts me scriptures and I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know. Truly is. All right, Cheryl.
If I got a good rising text message from Cheryl Leal.
She also, she's better at the internet than me, which is wild. Like she's on it and I'm not anymore. I'm not really on what's happening. And she sends me voice notes. It'll be like a 2-minute long voice note. She'll go, I just ran into someone who loves Abbott Elementary. And we had the best conversation, and I just want to tell you I love you and keep going. And I'll just be like, thanks, Cheryl. It just is incredible to have her in my life.
Yeah. I have a sibling that lives in Philadelphia, and she often sends me text messages about, you know, the specificities of how Philly the show is, even like that bag of Utz chips that Lisa's character is eating in that scene. And so I'm curious about how you negotiate, you know, obviously wanting to do some sort of like, not honor, but wanting to be realistic and wanting to be recognizable to people from Philly, to even yourself as someone who's from the city, and also just making sure that you like make a TV show that is good and consistently so.
To me, the specificity helps tell the story. You can't tell the story of a Philadelphia school without the nature of the city. That combination of Barbara and Melissa is very specifically Philly to me. I don't know, like getting that South Philly woman with the West Philly woman together. And there are unspoken things in Abbott, like, you know, the South Philadelphia Italians, half of them are Trump voters. That's just the truth. One of the biggest sandwich shops in Philly, cheesesteaks places, Pat's and Gino's are across from each other. I think it's Gino's. You go there to order a cheesesteak, you're minding your business, bam, Trump 2024 right in your face. You think I'm not going to order that cheesesteak? And that is the relationship of Philadelphians. It's so complicated and so messy, but that's what the city is. And so without that energy, I don't think Abbott would have been what it is. Do I love it? No, but it is the reality of the situation in Philadelphia. And I just think being specific really helps tell this story.
At this point, we're gonna take some audience questions, and you guys have sent in some really beautiful ones, actually. Ooh, I like this one. I'm gonna pretend like I asked you this. What is the atmosphere like during table reads?
Oh, our table reads are really fun. I'm always excited for the cast to see the scripts because that's very often the first time they get to see them. We have a ball, especially Cheryl, because Cheryl, she's so funny. She does her line, she executes, but then Cheryl just starts following along with the story, and she'll just be sitting in the middle of the table read like, oh, and she's so audible, and especially with Gregory Janine stuff, she's kind of my barometer, because Cheryl will straight up be like, ooh, and Cheryl, be quiet. And it's always, I don't know, it's so fun to watch them say the lines for the first time. And what's been really cool is our camera crew comes to table reads now. Because with mockumentary, the camera crew is so integral to the storytelling. So now they're coming to table reads to get a jump on how they're going to film the episode. Because I cannot, you know, I don't know if they'll see this, but Brenda, Jeremiah, Drew, all these people who work on our camera crew, we couldn't do it without them. And they're so, so much a part of the storytelling. So it's a big old grand old time. They've gotten a little bit too big, actually. I'm going to start limiting the capacity of the table reads because they're jam-packed, but it's really fun.
Okay, here's another great question. What is the most impactful no you've ever received, and what did it lead to?
I will say it was for the show I sold to CBS, Quentin Jermaine with Larry. I learned so much through that experience, and by the end of it, the show wasn't something that I'm sure I would have been proud of, but I went through the process, loved working with Larry and Jermaine, and I think they felt the same. It had been turned into something that we didn't intend for it to be.
Can you tell us more about the premise of the show?
The premise of the show was Jermaine and I were going to be two 25-year-olds from D.C. who were friends, who one night wound up sleeping together, and my character was going to get pregnant, and they were going to stay friends and figure out how to co-parent this child. I think what was confusing about it was we believed in a world in which this could really happen and happens every day, and we believed it could happen for these two black kids from D.C. I think that was a hard concept. And we didn't want to make it nasty. We were like, this is a comedy. This is something that people go through all the time. Like pregnancy, it's crazy how much unplanned pregnancy or single mothers are still a little taboo. And it's wild to see. It's one of those things that makes me hyper aware to black women having children in America. It's a weirdly very taboo subject. And I know so many girls who have children and are very happy women. They're single mothers. They're not sitting somewhere in a ditch. I'm not saying it's not hard. I'm saying that people are resilient. And in that is beauty, life, goodness, kindness, resilience. And that was hard to get past. So when we were told no, I was honestly relieved. I was like, I didn't want to make the version of the story that they wanted to make. I wanted to make something that was a little bit more realistic. And I think that experience helped me to know that I wanted to make something like Abbott. It helped birth a character like Tariq in the show, who is not a bad guy. These are just people, and people are messy. And black people get to be messy too. It's not unique to just, you know, Chandler and Joey and Ross and Rachel. I was watching Friends on the plane. I'm like, yo, Ross is really fucking crazy, honestly. What a lunatic. So,
as you were talking, I realized there's a through line here, if you'll allow me to speculate on what your like larger thesis of your work is that black stories or stories in general don't always have to be told on the register of being extraordinary. These are like very ordinary situations.
Yes.
And you can imagine that when you go to a network and you say, okay, two friends, they're going to raise this child together, but they're not going to be in a romantic situation. You can imagine all the like, well, is this a negative portrayal? Like, is this something that we actually see in society? And it's like, there's a huge gap between the everydayness, the ordinariness of our lives and what is shown on television.
I think absolutely.
You can imagine, you could totally see Abbott being told as like a kind of like doldrums kind of dark story.
Yeah.
And I think the intervention is in the tenor of like humor and messiness.
I agree with you. This is why I love you, Doreen.
This is why I love you.
Because you say stuff that I don't know how to articulate that. It's happening in my brain, but yes, that's exactly how I feel. That is exactly how I feel.
So, Quinta, thank you so much
thank
for being so kind.
Thank you guys so much.
Quinta Brunson, the creator and star of Abbott Elementary. She spoke with Doreen Sanfelix, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After six acclaimed seasons, The Good Fight is finally coming to an end. The finale aired this month. And the show's end is a bittersweet one, since in the minds of many critics and fans, it captured the tensions of our current moment like no other program on the air. It starred Christine Baranski as Diane Lockhart, a Chicago attorney who's a die-hard liberal coping with life in Trump's America.
I'm delighted to welcome Christine Baranski, who's not only a quadruple and probably more threat performer and a radical fashion inspiration. But my personal guide through today's political hellscape.
Emily Nussbaum is a staff writer, and she writes often about television for the magazine. She talked with Christine Baranski at the New Yorker Festival back in 2018, kind of early in the run of The Good Fight. They spoke about the show's politics, the Me Too movement, and more. Baranski had a long career in theater before her breakout moment on television in the 90s as the hard-drinking buddy to Sybil Shepherd's character on Sybil. Here's Emily.
Christine is a 15-time Emmy Award nominee. She's won two Tonys for The Real Thing and Rumors. And she has a house in Connecticut where she gets to go skinny dipping at night. So basically, she's living the life. Welcome, Christine Baranski.
Thank you.
We were talking backstage and we immediately went into a political rabbit hole. So rather than start with anything political, I'm going to start with a clip from Mamma Mia. Now you're so cute. I like your style. And I know what you mean when you give me a flash of that smile. Oh, but my hair only a child. Well, I can dance with you, honey. If you think it's funny, dance your mom and know that you're out. And I'm the child, make it clear.
Maybe we should all just sit around singing ABBA songs.
You know?
This is the first Mamma Mia, of course. The second one
right.
just appeared this summer, which I thought was a public service because mm-hmm. it... I mean, you go from being, God, this is really kind of silly, and oh, God. And then I realized the world really needs a couple of hours to still believe life is joyous and people get along and there's sensuality and a belief in love. And there's just a goofy innocence about the movie that's really, as I said, it performs a function now.
So I'm going to show another clip and we're going to jump right to The Good Fight. And this trip is called Trump Derangement Syndrome.
This is deranged. This is the Trump derangement syndrome. You're just as bad as you're accusing him of being.
No, I'm just done with being the adult in the room. I am done with being the compliant and the sensible one, standing stoically by while the other side picks my pockets, while the other side gerrymanders Democrats out of existence, a 3 million person majority, and we lost the presidency. A Congress that keeps a Supreme Court justice from being seated because he was chosen by a Democratic president.
That's not what happened.
That is exactly what happened, Julius.
Okay, then. Take to the streets. Man the barricades. Because if that's what you really think, you've given up on the law. You've gone well beyond any...
Actually, you don't know. I have a Smith & Wesson 64 in my desk, and I'm this close to taking to the streets.
There's an uncanny synchronicity to this character. As I watch this, my eyes are welling up in tears as I watch this. It's so of the moment. It's just brilliantly written, but it really puts intelligent, liberal-minded people who believe in the liberal democratic
tradition and society and in their country, puts them in a workplace and lets them bump into each other and mix ideas and make intellectual arguments that are complex and not strident, but that this woman, this Diane character, for having fought the good fight all her life, being a woman who probably followed Hillary into, you know, through Wellesley and championed her and had to, you know, knock on the glass ceiling many times and finds herself at this present moment living in a country where we're backsliding in terms of women's rights. It's a marvelous role to play, and it's a marvelous show to be on because the writers just kind of take us into the belly of the beast and let us live in that world.
And The Good Fight was supposed to be a show about Hillary being president. Instead, it was a show about Trump being president, which obviously transformed the show.
We shot that pilot the days before and the days after the election. And then, of course, we had to rewrite the pilot because the presumption was Diane was going to retire because there are no more glass ceilings to break, and she gets the house in the south of France, and then she loses her money. But there was a speech at the very beginning where she's talking about, you know, there are no more glass ceilings to break. And it was written as a line thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president. And so that line was taken out, and we had to rewrite the episode. So now it seems like Diane got the house in the south of France because she didn't want to live in the United States.
Every element of it just changes context.
This seems like a good lead-in to a clip from Sybil. So let's go to a clip from Sybil.
Champagne for everyone at that table.
Champagne at lunch? Oh, we haven't had that since yesterday.
Sybil, I have fabulous news. My prodigal son is returning.
Justin is coming home for Thanksgiving. That's wonderful. I knew he'd come back.
It's been 3 years, Sybil, without a word. You remember the night he left?
I'd just come back from that Save Our Furs benefit. He told me he hated my entire pampered, materialistic existence. Then he asked for $2,000 and left for Peru.
Maybe being away 3 years changed his mind, or maybe the money ran out.
Sybil, I don't want to celebrate another 40th birthday without him. I want to prove to him that I'm not something he has to run away from. And I'm going to start by showing him the best old-fashioned Thanksgiving we've ever had. Well, except for that one in Aruba with Ivana Trump and Richard Simmons.
I've got an idea. Why don't you bring Justin to my house? Everyone's in town. So I'm going to make a good old-fashioned Memphis Thanksgiving. I'm going to use all four Southern food groups. Sugar, salt, grease, and alcohol.
It sounds tempting, but I can't.
Oh, come on. The whole family's going to be there, and you're part of my family. Did I mention there'll be alcohol?
I'd love to, darling, but I want Justin all to myself this weekend. I'm even going to cook all his favorite health foods. Oh, one question. Is it still correct to call it brown rice, or is it rice of color?
Yeah, I watched all these old Sybils, and I have to say, it is a very surreal show to watch because it is a real time capsule of the period. Like, even like the Ivana...
Look at the hair.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
What was that like the first year that you were making Sybil? Because there really was this... complete. And also, actually, I was wondering, because you came largely as a stage actress, and television was in a very different stage.
Oh, God, yeah. And there was still that conflict of, you know, if you did television, you were giving up the theater. I mean, now it's everybody's doing everything, and actually everybody wants a job on television because there's so much great writing on television. But at that time, I was seriously conflicted. And I was in my early 40s by then, and I had just... except for some films, I was really a theater actress and defined myself that way. Plus, they weren't shooting shows in New York. For the most part, all especially sitcoms, were shot in LA, and I had two children, and I didn't want to raise them in LA. So I just kept turning down pilots, and then they approached me about this, and the character was meant to be a kind of ab fab Joanna Lumley type. And I was doing the math on how much it would cost to educate my two daughters, and it seemed like the theater was not going to, you know, provide that kind of income. So I began to seriously consider it. But it was a really tortured decision, and my manager, who's here today, she'll tell you. I mean, she really had to talk me into it, and the night before I left, I almost called her in the middle of the night to say, I just don't think I can do it. It's too big a step, and I decided not to move the children to LA, but that we would try my commuting back and forth. So, but it was a huge, for some reason, a huge psychological jump for me to go to Hollywood and to do a sitcom. That said, if ever there was a sitcom that was right for me to do at that moment in time, it was that role. And in that show, Chuck Lorre wrote the pilot, and I did accept it on the basis of the pilot, which just, I thought, this character, there's, you know, she's just got those great, you know, whip-smart one-liners. And the one line that sold me on the whole project was when Sybil's just out of the blue says, you know something, you know what's amazing, Marianne? And my response is, they make vodka from wheat. Just, there's something there about that writing that I think I can work with this. And I told Chuck that, and he later confessed, it's not a Chuck Lorre line, it's his writing partner, Lee Aronson, who's a recovered alcoholic. But anyway, yeah, that character, within 13 episodes, I won an Emmy for that. And to that I attribute, you know, I give it over to Chuck Lorre and the writing of that character. No one had seen that woman on American television. They'd seen Ab Fab. But she was the first out of the gate. Sex and the City came later. But the woman with the martini, who was sort of a badass in her outfits and her attitude, that was the first of its kind. And boy, it changed my career. Those were really hard years. I hated living alone in a hotel. I missed my kids so desperately, but it's why I'm here. It's why I'm had a relationship all those years with CBS. It was a turning point in my career. And who goes to Hollywood at 42 and, you know, is an overnight, you know, kind of star in that way that you become a star because of television? I mean, I was a well-known theater actress, but not a celebrity, not a star. No.
I wanted to, you talk about your long relationship with CBS. I'm wondering how people are responding to what's going on with Les Moonves.
It is shocking, but that's where the culture is, and it's a clarifying moment in our culture, and I think it's going to be messy before it gets better, but I will miss Les. Yeah.
I was wondering, with you and your daughters, who are a lawyer, and like, when you've had conversations about what's going on, do you find there to be a generational difference between you and your perspectives on some of these issues, or is that not so true?
Only slightly. Well, yes, I did get into one conversation with my daughter about men's behavior and how I was raised. I was raised, you know, in a Catholic background, in all-girls Catholic high school, and it was just instilled in us as young women that men were that way, that they couldn't control themselves after a certain point. I mean, I literally was told, if you let a man touch you anywhere below the neck, he might turn into an uncontrollable wild animal, and it's your responsibility if you get pregnant. You have to control the narrative. And I told this to my daughter, and she said, no is no at any point, in the evening, if no matter what's going on. I said, that's interesting. That's just not the way I was raised. I would never go to a man's room late at night. I just assume that he might very well behave badly. And there's that difference, but it's how we were raised. But I'm proud of my daughters. I think they're very savvy about their feminism, and they're not strident, but they're clear-headed about it and pragmatic. And one of my daughters did get a law degree, and she was really agonizing whether or not to go to law school. It's such a huge commitment. And I said, look, you can rail against the world, but if you want to change things, you've got to know how the system works. And becoming a lawyer, as Diane did, you figure out how the system works, however flawed it is, and then you figure out how to change it. But, you know, blogging and railing against the machine with a lot of hyperbole, a lot of screaming isn't going to get us there. And I think at this moment in time for women, it's the most important time to be clear-headed, rational, as well as passionate and angry. Channel the anger in an intelligent, clear, forward-moving way.
It's so hard to talk about this stuff because I find myself feeling all these emotional feelings and wanting to escape from it all. You went to Oxford to study, right?
I did. My other daughter, Lily, got a graduate degree at Wolfson College at Oxford in anthropology. And when I took her there to, help her move in, I was just utterly captivated by Oxford. And one of my deep regrets in my life is that I did not have a real college education and academic experience in that way. I went straight to Juilliard, which, although it was a prestigious acting school, was trade school. You know, I learned the craft of acting, and I'm happy I did, and that was my great passion. But I've always longed to go back to school and use more of my brain and my intellect. So there's a summer course called the Oxford Experience, and next year, I'm signed up for the Duke of Wellington, one week, and then the Meaning of Life the following week. So I'll do 2 weeks next year.
The Meaning of Life just as a subject matter?
Yeah, why not?
Not like the Monty Python film.
No, yeah. No, just the Meaning of Life in 1 week at Oxford. You should have me back next year. I'll have all the answers.
You know a whole situation.
So this is it.
Thank you so much to everybody for coming. And thank you to Christine Baranski.
Emily Nussbaum speaking with Christine Baranski at the New Yorker Festival in 2018. The Good Fight had its finale this month, and you can stream all 6 seasons on Paramount Plus. I'm David Remnick. Hope you had a great holiday, and I hope you'll join us next time for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Adam Howard, Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Meher Bhatia, Amy Pearl, and James Napoli. And special thanks to Catherine Sterling, Amanda Miller, Nico Brown, and Michael Etherington.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.